Blog Talk Radio.
Sunday, and this is the Sunday Show with Jack Jodell and F. Wayne Johnson, myself, Gwen Berry, and our special guest tonight. We're really happy to have Burr Deming with us. And Jack, why don't you introduce Burr?
Yeah, sounds great. Burr, we're very happy to have you with us tonight. You're the chief author or chief writer and creator of the fabulous blog known as fairandunbalanced.com. And boy, have I seen a lot of thought-provoking articles over at your blog over the ages here. It's just been wonderful to see it and read it. And now you're getting into podcasting, and we'll cover all of that as we go on a little bit later. But we want to extend a hearty welcome to you, and we're very glad you were able to join us today.
Well, thank you.
Yep, very, very glad to have you. Say, Burr, how did you come up with that name, fairandunbalanced.com? Is it just a play off of Fox News' nonsense, or what? How did you do that?
Yes, it is. And we were, I was talking with siblings who actually did set up the blog site and are the actual owners of it, and they drafted me into writing for it a while back. It was going to be a temporary thing. So we'll see how long it goes.
Good luck.
When did
that,
it start? When did it start, Burr?
I think about 8 years ago.
8 years ago, yeah. Okay, great. Well, I just want to mention you were very kind to me in my early days of blogging. I'm in my seventh year now, and I had no idea how long you'd been around, but all of a sudden you were one of the early commenters, And so that's how I checked out your blog and gradually got to know the blogosphere pretty well. And you're very, very, you're the master of critical thinking, if I may say so myself. I just, your articles so many times have been so profound, and you have a real wry sense of humor that you employ now and then. It's very, very incredibly well done. And so I encourage everybody to visit fairandunbalanced.com. You will not be disappointed. It always is thought-provoking and always leaves you thinking.
Well, I appreciate that, Jack. Actually, my family and friends sometimes have a tendency to forget that I am hilarious.
Unlike any recent memory here that we have of you.
Yeah.
Say, where did you grow up? Where were you raised and stuff, Burr?
Well, I'm still in the process of growing up. I was born in Upper New York State about halfway between, I guess about halfway between Syracuse and Buffalo and near Rochester, New York.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I moved to St. Louis briefly when my parents moved here. I was a young adult, but I came here and then went to Washington, D.C. area for a long time and then moved back.
Oh, okay. And what kind of schooling have you had? Because you're very astute intellectually, and your writing definitely shows that. So I'm just kind of curious where you had schooling and all that sort of thing.
Well, most of my schooling was in various places in Upper New York State when I was in secondary school.
Okay.
Post-secondary school was in Brockport, New York.
Mm-hmm.
At the State University College of Brockport is what they were calling the system, State University College at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I think they changed it to SUNY because people got tired of saying, of responding, where did you go to school? And they would say, suck Brockport. You know, so.
Great. And how is it that you became so politically aware, and when did that occur for you?
Well, it was a long time ago when I was a sub-teen. You know, it was my dad and I would watch television, and he would explain current events to me.
Cool.
I remember very vividly watching. I remember watching civil rights demonstrations in the South, and I still remember my dad explaining to me when I was saying, "Looks like they're playing in water," and he said, "No, they're being blasted off of sidewalks by water that is strong enough to strip the bark off of trees."
Yeah,
and we watched. Yeah. We watched silently after that, and it made a deep impression on me. When John F. Kennedy was killed, I reacted inordinately. My parents were concerned for years after that because, as my dad put it, John F. Kennedy was killed and life just wasn't worth living. I had nightmares about it throughout my teenage
years. It was a very traumatic time, and I was just going to mention, we did grow up in a very traumatic time. We had the Civil Rights era. We had John Kennedy being assassinated, of all things, a young, youthful, vibrant president all of a sudden killed. And then we had Vietnam and all that kind of, and Nixon, and we had all kinds of things to keep us preoccupied.
Well, I'd also interject, too, that Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy,
we
all saw kind of, you know, in kind of a replay real time of what the hell happened.
Yeah.
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 Very turbulent time.
I got to tell you, gentlemen, I remember as a child actually seeing the film on television of Jack Ruby shooting
Lee Harvey Oswald. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a very traumatic time. And, yes, we have gone through we are a generation that has seen the birth of the atomic age.
Oh, yeah, incredible. Yeah, absolutely incredible. Well, that's interesting, Burr. That's great. Were you ever an activist, or were you? Just kind of drift along like some folks did, or how did you? I mean, you're very politically aware, and your dad is credited for bringing that up out in you. But were you involved in any particular causes? Like, did you march against the war or anything like that?
Yeah, I was involved when I was in college.
Right. Okay.
You know, when I was in high school, I actually wrote articles supporting the war.
Yeah, I was kind of brainwashed for a while too.
Well, I totally bought into the prevailing idea that of the domino theory. And,
exactly.
You know, when the power of ideas is really more profound than a lot of times we give them credit for.
Right.
And in my mind, we went into Vietnam as partly as a reaction to Neville Chamberlain in World War II. We're never going to let that happen again. And then we were captivated by the idea of communism as a monolithic conspiracy.
Right. We were so brainwashed into that and so deluded, really, the whole country was. There must have been a few people who knew what
was
going on.
Policy makers, everybody was. You know, and there was a lot of truth to Soviet Union as an expansionist society.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of brainwashing going on there, too.
Oh, yeah.
And the idea was that we really need to invade adjoining countries in order to provide a buffer.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure that we're never invaded again, because that was a traumatic experience in the Soviet Union. On our side, we looked at the expansion of a dictatorship into adjoining countries as a model for worldwide conquest.
Yeah, right.
And so, therefore, pretty much everything was colored by that. So when North Vietnam and South Vietnam are divided in the 1950s, and then North Vietnam says, well, to heck with that, we're going to invade, you know, so-called invade South Vietnam. They didn't view it as an invasion.
Right.
They viewed it as this should be a unified country. It was a very natural thing for those of us that, for pretty much everyone that was, it was raised, you know, our parents and grandparents who were profoundly affected by Neville Chamberlain's and Munich react to that as one more incident in the worldwide conspiracy.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I remember
we went from that into, you know, a lot of people lost their lives over this mistaken idea.
Oh yeah.
Now, yeah, there were other factors. There was greed, and there was institutional support for the idea. But the idea had its origins, and there were very rational people who totally believed it.
Yeah, very true.
Let me interject here. I had a school teacher in high school, and his cousin was Pearl S. Buck, who wrote The Green Earth.
Oh, yeah.
Her parents were missionaries in China. And she came and spoke at our high school, and just a little podunk high school out in the middle of the country on the Delmarva Peninsula. And one of the epic statements that she made, I was a senior that year, and, you know, coming up for the draft, and they said, she says, "The United States will never win a complete victory in Vietnam because it is just nothing more than a country tried to reunify itself after European colonization
separate."
Well, I'm thinking I'm the only one in the crowd who wore a Che Guevara T-shirt in those days, aren't I?
Probably.
Yeah, I think so. But that's okay. Now I'm envious, okay?
Now, Burr, you mentioned, was it your sibling, your children got you into blogging? Was that it?
No, my siblings.
Your brother, sister.
They were interested in starting up a website, and none of them were very familiar with websites. You know,
right.
So there was a lot of communication back and forth with, message boards that they confused with pods, pod sites, and with and I said, well, I've had a little bit of knowledge just in going from one to another, and I'd been participating in some chat rooms, and so they were conflating a lot of things together, but they were impressed with every once in a while there'd be an exchange that, I'd copy down and send to them because I thought it was kind of funny. People were saying things that I thought were clever. And they said, well, why don't we chart something like that? Because you're pretty good at that, Burr, so we'll go ahead and have you write a couple of things. And they envisioned something completely different than what a website would normally generate.
Oh.
We've actually graduated more towards that because we've attracted enough interest from comment-type people. And some of the comments are long enough and are profound enough, really, so that they've selected some and posted them.
Yeah.
And
now,
we have a lot of guest authors, actually.
I've noticed that over the years. Now, might one of your siblings be named Raymond?
Yeah.
Because he contributes quite a bit.
Yeah,
that's great. And I've noticed over the years a lot of different people commenting from time. And I used to do it quite a bit, too. And when I had more time, but I'm taking care of my 93-year-old father now, it's all I can do to write my own blog. But I do get around. But I want to ask you, man, you get around like mad. I mean, every week you post a review of a bunch of different blogs, and many times you've included mine, and I'm very grateful to you for that. But I actually read those things. You get a little synopsis of what their article is all about, and you put a link there leading people right to that website. And Burr, that's incredible, the amount of time you must spend reading other people's blogs. I don't know where the time comes from for you, man. You must be living on a 36-hour day.
Yeah. Well, time travel really does help.
Well, there you go. So you're a Doctor Who fan, right?
Yeah, there you go.
That's good.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, the amount of, I got to give you credit, too. You're so good with your critical thinking, it's really hard for anybody to argue you down. Although a number of conservative people try to, they never succeed in my mind, but you're very, very open-minded, and you really critically analyze what they present you with, and you feature some of their blogs in your review each week, and that's a credit to you, too. You're a very open-minded man, and you think about things deeply. And, boy, I've been amazed at some of the profoundness in some of your articles. It's just been incredible.
Well, I have an empathy for people with different viewpoints a lot of times, and sometimes they'll convince me of things, and you know, but I'm T-Pain is a fellow that has gotten to be a friend of mine over the years.
Yes, I've noticed a lot of his comments and stuff. Yeah.
A lot of it is not apparent to casual readers because it occurs behind the scenes.
Yeah.
I've never met him face to face, but I've gotten to be a pretty good friend with him. If I encountered him on a subway somewhere and overheard him for a couple of minutes, I'd recognize him from the content of what he says.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I must tell you a little bit about him. He's in his relationship with me. He started sending us notes when he found out that a relative of mine that's very, very close had a serious illness that is typically fatal. I won't say who it is.
Okay.
But he would write to me because I'd mentioned to him once offline. He's written to me when I posted something once about my stepson going to Afghanistan and the anxiety that we were feeling. And he sent a comment in, but he was continually sending private notes of reassurance and prayer. And
well, that's great.
You know, he hasn't hesitated to be encouraging. You know, so I provoke him at times because I'll send him an advance copy of something I'm about to post, along with a note saying to him, "Are you really going to let me get away with this?"
Oh, there you go.
And he usually comes through for me. He'll post something that that my brother can post.
Yeah, I've seen him. Well, on many occasions, I've seen him post something refuting what you were trying to present, and then you'll counter with a counter refutation. And it's kind of interesting to see the interplay between the two of you. And it's nice that, you know, you guys, you disagree. You probably always will disagree, but you're always civil with each other, and that's the way to be, you know. This name calling and stuff, we could leave that in the dungeon somewhere and just let's you know, you can lay your cards on the table without fear of retribution or concrete criticism or constructive criticism. That's fine. But when you get into name-calling and bashing people verbally, who needs that stuff? And you guys are both gentlemanly in your approach. I've got to salute you both on that. And it's just part of your heritage, I guess, at Fair and Unbalanced, Burr, and we appreciate it a great deal.
Yeah, well, thank you.
You bet.
I was kind of influenced by, when I was a kid, weekly telecasts of William F. Buckley.
Oh yes, yeah.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Let me interject here.
William F. Buckley today could not be considered a Republican. They would throw him out.
Yeah,
yeah.
On the other hand, I'm not sure Republicans would survive being in the Republican Party with William F. Buckley, because I think the Republican Party, when he first came into play, was trending in the same direction that it's trending into now.
Right.
And well, he and a couple of people really stood against it and almost strategized to transform the entire thing into something.
He did. He moderated it quite a bit. He knocked out all the Birchers, you know. That was very interesting.
Yep. That was true. It was a pleasure to hear him talk sometimes, even if he didn't agree.
Yeah.
Well, I was also remotely intimidated. As I would imagine myself, if I was in a conversation with somebody like that, how would I survive? You know, it's just, and so I started reading and cataloging some things. You know, it was part of what I needed to do in high school in the social studies class was to subscribe to Newsweek and to offer an opinion on something from Newsweek every week.
Oh, great.
So what I started doing early on is to actually trying to index everything I could find in Newsweek on little index cards.
Mm-hmm.
I'd read these articles and index them, and I don't even remember why particularly I decided to do that for easy reference so that I could do that. But what I had envisioned in my mind is, what if I met somebody that was that articulate as a conservative? How would I be able to hold up my end? And so I just had this fantasy in my mind, and I was captivated enough by it, so I started trying to keep myself informed.
Right. Now, I'm very curious. You're an unabashed, for the most part, liberal, I believe, from what you're writing. That's what I take it to be. And I'm just kind of curious, when you were growing up, now, did you come from like a working-class family, a lower middle-class family, solidly middle-class? How did you come about getting these leftist ideas and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I've always been a knee-jerk liberal jerk. You know, it was, my dad was a Methodist minister for a long time.
Oh, okay.
And this was back when people in the ministry were itinerant poor people. I mean, it was just nobody. Parishes typically didn't pay much of anything.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
He told me early on about
the circuit riders.
Almost, yeah. In fact, typically the length of time in any one community was between 2 and 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So they were on the road quite a bit.
Oh,
I remember him explaining to me how a very wealthy parishioner was complaining to him about the amount of taxes that he paid. And he said to my dad at the time, "You know, I pay more every year in taxes than you earn." And my dad thought to himself, "You know, I just hope that someday I'm in a position to pay that much in taxes." One of my earliest memories was, it wasn't even my memory, it was my mom telling me that when my dad was, we didn't have running water in the house. In his very first parish that he was in, and so they were digging a well outside, and they were she was watching as he held this giant stake, and another fellow that was up on a ladder was swinging a sledgehammer down within inches of his head to hammer this big giant stake into the ground.
Uh-huh.
The guy who was doing the hammering had recently been released from a psychiatric institution.
Oh.
So she spent quite a bit of time looking out the window.
Yeah, understandably.
He was, I tell people, there's a friend of mine who encountered a tragedy one time. In fact, I was working for him for a while. He happened to be my boss. That's how we met. He was 23 years old, and people would ask me, you know, "Do you resent working for somebody that much younger than you?" And I said, "Well, no, what I resent is working for somebody that's so much more mature than me." he would ask me, you know, he had lost his parents when he was a teenager.
Sure.
And another close relative had committed suicide that he was extremely close to at about the same time.
Oh,
he went through some pretty rough times. And he said to me, "Burr, how long did it take you to get over it after your dad died? How do you answer that?" So I said to him, "I'll let you know."
Yeah.
And
I tell
people that my dad was... I tell people that I've met in my life maybe 5 truly great men. And my dad was 3 of them.
Wow.
Very nice. Very nice.
When he was in Upper New York State as a preacher in the 1950s, he watched political events occurring, and at one point in one little community, he stood up and made a speech and actually preached a sermon about McCarthyism. And
good
immediately became, well, yeah,
But he paid the price for it.
It wasn't real good for him at the time. There were howls for his scalp. I mean, there were demands that he be transferred, and he wasn't, at least not right away. The bishop stood his ground and kept him there, and
good.
For another couple of years, and then eventually sent him to another little town where he got into promptly another controversy.
Mm-hmm.
They had a minstrel show. And my dad said you can't be doing blackface. I mean, you just can't be doing it. And it's wrong.
Uh-huh.
And they went through the traditional arguments. Well, listen, some of my best friends are black people, and they don't seem to have a problem with it, and that
right.
kind of thing. I mean, just
yeah.
Nowadays we would recognize them as being trite, but they considered them to be really profoundly effective arguments back then.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So my dad based a sermon loosely on an article that had been written, I think, by Norman Cousins, but I'm not sure. The title of the sermon, just to give you an idea, was took a phrase from one of the books by Paul in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, know the truth, and the truth will make you sick. It was about the minstrel show.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, well.
And throughout the rest of his life, he would hear back from people after that about how deeply resentful people still felt. But by golly, they did change that minstrel show. They went, they took away blackface.
Well, good. That's a good aspect of it. And you know, we've got to admire your father. I wish I could have met him. I wish he were still alive today so I could speak with him. But we've got to admire your father for his courage. It took a lot of courage. And was born out of conviction, and he wasn't out to offend anybody. He just wanted to get his point across, and that's part of being an American, I look at. So I salute your father for that.
Well, I would actually add in there, he was also a spiritual mentor of the community, and he embraced
right.
that completely, and I admire that a great deal for him.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, and it sounds like to me from our conversation, and the listeners can hear it too, is he embedded those values into the man we're talking to right now. So
very true. Very
yeah.
true. Way
and
to go.
My kudos to you and your dad on that aspect.
Yes. Very good.
I appreciate that. I do try to mimic him sometimes, you know.
Well, you're
to create that illusion anyway.
Deep and often profound writer, Burr, and I salute you tremendously for that. That's why one of the reasons I keep coming back all the time. And I'm so delighted that you started podcasting on my site, sharing your podcast and that. By the way, let's talk about podcasting. It's been about 2 years now, or a year and a half. When did you first get into that, and how did that happen?
I think I've been in it for time, you know, has a tendency when you get to be my age of flowing very rapidly.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, it's easy to lose track of how long you're doing something. So I think
right.
it's been about 3 years. It might have been
that long. Wow.
Longer. Yeah.
Okay. I just became aware of it maybe 18 or 20 months ago when you first approached me put some of them on my site, and I was very glad to have you do it because, first of all, I admire your writing so much, and then when I heard the podcast myself, I thought, this is incredible, and I, you know, I'd heard of podcasting. I've never done it, but I'd heard of it, and it's a new and kind of upcoming thing. It's been around for a while, but not a lot of people are doing it. But it's kind of trendy in a way, in a good way, and you've jumped right onto it.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to do. It takes a lot of time.
Oh yeah,
and there's a lot more involved in it than I would have thought at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of technology there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I get a little bit of help, but a lot of it is on me to do the writing and a lot of
sure.
the recording.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're grateful to you for it.
With another voice, and so we need to do a little bit of scheduling and a lot of remixing.
Oh, yeah, sure. Now, who does the other? You said somebody else does the other voice?
Yeah, I can't tell you who that is, but
that's fine.
I can't
no problem.
But
I
always talk about virtual fictitious assistant.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So
and it's very clever.
That's the name of our voice, you know.
Yeah.
Our virtual fictitious assistant.
It's very clever, and for those who don't know about it, you can always hear Burr's podcasts at his own site, fairandunbalanced.com. They occur at least once a week and oftentimes several times a week. And I feature one of them every Monday on my site at the Saturday Afternoon Post. And I'm very happy to have them there. And they're just like his writing. I mean, they're taken from his writing. Just he records them and then speaks them and uses the virtual fictitious assistant to help him. So it's worth a listen, and I encourage people to go to one site or either or both to check them out. So it's been kind of nice this past year and a half, couple years, Bert, to have Mondays off and then do my own thing on Thursday or Friday or something like that and share the site with you. It's been very, very nice. And I've noticed a little uptick in my readership, I guess, on the days that you're on there. So that's nice.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Yeah, so do I. So great. I encourage you to keep up the good work. You know, you've done so many memorable podcasts, one of which was, I forget when it was. I think it was last year or I can't remember. It's a while back, though. But it left such an impression on me. First of all, on your site, there is a picture, I think, that accompanied it. It happened to do with the old textile workers. A mother and her child were working, and they were locked in, and they couldn't get out, and so they had to, when the fire struck the building, they had to jump out the window, and they ended up jumping to their deaths, and some photographer clicked that picture, and it just struck me so profound, the sight of that picture, that poor woman and her child leaping, you know, hoping that they'd survive, and I'm sure they didn't, but it was just incredible, because it kind of coincided with the rise of Rand Paul and his libertarian nonsense ideas, and I think I responded to it accordingly in my blog, and it just was it really impacted me greatly, and I still remember it to this day. Great job, Bert.
Jack, it wasn't the Triangle Factory in New York, was it?
No,
that was a big
the Triangle Factory in the Triangle incident in New York. This is where a lot of textile workers were trapped in a building, and there were a phenomenal number, I think 150 something, that were killed because they couldn't get out.
Right.
They had the escape doors chained and locked, and
that's right.
And there were
keys to unlock them, but they were kept in an office that most people couldn't get to.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right.
There were multiple women, too.
Yeah, that's right.
What was that, Gwen?
Now, that created an atmosphere where there was a reform that went around the country, and every building that was more than a few stories had to have a fire escape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Boston was one of the communities that, it was a city that put that ordinance in. You had to have a fire escape. Well, what they didn't do is to put in any kind of regulations about the construction of the fire escape,
mm-hmm.
the way it was put together or the materials that were used. So in 1975, there was a fire. And Diana Bryant, a 19-year-old woman who was helping to raise a stepchild, it was her stepchild,
mm-hmm.
was trapped in a fire and went out onto the fire escape. There was a fireman who risked his life. He managed to get on top of the building. This was on the top floor. And couldn't quite reach her, so he jumped down next to her on the fire escape. There was a ladder that was approaching, a fire ladder that was approaching. He was reaching for the fire ladder. You could see a whole series of photographs. A photographer
mm-hmm.
was watching this dramatic rescue.
Mm-hmm.
And just as he was reaching for it, he had her in one arm. He was reaching for the fire ladder in the other arm.
Mm-hmm.
She had her little 2-year-old daughter, her stepdaughter, mm-hmm. with her. She in her arms.
Mm-hmm.
And the fire escape collapsed.
Oh, yeah.
And so there was a dramatic picture. It won a Pulitzer Prize in 1976. That's when I saw it.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. Incredible. And it left its impression on me, I'll tell you. And your tie-in to the anti-regulation crowd that want to have no restrictions on anything, and that's how I tied it into Rand Paul, was just incredible. And I have never forgotten that. It was one of the best things I've ever seen you do.
It affected me a great deal. I've had nightmares. I've had dreams about it ever since.
Oh, yeah, I can understand why.
I've always wondered, what would happen? What kind of life these folks would have led? What kind of mother she would have been?
Yeah.
Now, she survived. She didn't survive. I mean, it was a five-story fall onto hard asphalt.
Right, gosh.
Her and her daughter, the pictures of her falling with her daughter just a few feet above. She's
right.
Face downward. You can't really even see her face because her arms are in the way.
Right.
And falling head first, her daughter is above her with her arms and legs flailing apart.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the picture that won a Pulitzer Prize, and that's where I saw it. And it not only affected me, it affected Boston. Boston
mm-hmm.
put in new regulations.
Good.
Now, Diana Bryant died. Nobody really understands for sure why her daughter survived. I mean, it was
no
an impossible
kidding.
Fall.
Incredible.
The 2-year-old survived?
The 2-year-old survived. The current speculation is that her fall was cushioned by the blood
mother.
And flush of her mom.
Yeah, that could be.
Her mom hit the pavement. She fell on top, probably. She seriously injured. It was near death for several days after that, and they managed to pull her out.
Oh, what a
wow.
marvel.
So, my thought was that she was saved. She wasn't saved by regulations. She wasn't saved by the fire escape. She wasn't saved by the kind of rules that should have been in effect. She was saved by the death of her stepmother.
Yeah.
I was going to say the sacrifice of the mother saved the child.
But, had the regulations been enforced and in place, that entire accident may never have occurred, and that's, I think, important to note, too.
Yeah, she sure wasn't saved by libertarianism, and she wasn't saved by regulations that she should have been saved by.
Right, right.
Sure.
Yeah.
I've always remembered that, and every once in a while I'll meet some young person, and I'll thank God. I sure hope that you live a long life.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that was very notable, and I've never forgotten it, Burr. It was the most remarkable post I'd ever seen anywhere, and I was glad to see that. Now, did you do a podcast on that one, or was that before you were podcasting for me?
Yeah, I did. I did a podcast on that
I think
one.
You did. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. It was probably one of the early ones that I featured that you co-did on my site, which was wonderful. But boy, what a tremendously horrid event! And that picture is worth 18 million words. It's just so striking. It's so incredible and unforgettable. And good Lord. Yeah, it's something else. Well, anyway, it's one of the many remarkable posts and podcasts you've done over the many years now, Burr, and I'm very grateful to be in association with you on them. It's really been enlightening and enjoyable and all those good words, all in one. So I encourage you to keep on going. I greatly admire your writing, and just keep it up, man. You're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
I have a question for you, Burr. I don't know if you've posted on it, but certainly you've been thinking about it with all of these massive migrations and all of the refugees that are flooding Europe and all the whole gobbledygook of what is going on over there. And then the political atmosphere here in America. What?
I was just going to say, talk about a time for introspection of current events. We are definitely going down the wrong path here in this country.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was wondering, Burr, what are your thoughts on right now, the reflection of that?
And the Syrian refugees and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, what's going on over there?
I've been thinking about this, actually, prior to that. I wrote something a couple of years ago. There was a remark that was, I'm sure that everybody considered it an innocent remark, and when you're on the air, you can't help but throw out things every once in a while that are absurd or stupid or cruel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just almost impossible. So I have some empathy for people, but Dana Perino on Fox News, a former press secretary to President Bush,
The
second President Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she was talking about how absurd it was that Obamacare was being offered in 150 languages. And what she said was that if somebody cannot speak enough English to fill in the forms, how will they be explaining their symptoms to a doctor? That was her observation.
Mm-hmm.
And that prompted me to write about a young woman from the Ukraine, as we called it then. Nowadays, mm-hmm. it's simply called Ukraine, but when I was a kid, it was the Ukraine.
Yeah.
Her name was Marie, and I have a sense that it was around the time of World War One.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Great War then. It was before we knew we had to number them.
Right.
And she was trying to get away from a forced marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And she arrived in New York without a whole lot of knowledge of America's customs and laws, and she didn't mm-hmm. speak English. And she would have, she had to have found other people who spoke her language. And she got word that the guy that she'd been promised to had come looking for her.
Uh-huh.
And so she avoided the authorities. I mean, she had no way of knowing whether they would hand her over. And besides, people in that part of Europe had a tradition of, based on unfortunate experience, of staying away from the police no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she was my grandmother.
Oh, wow. Love it. Love that story.
And
incredible.
The lore that came down, I'm not even sure, I don't know if it's accurate, and I'm not even sure if it came from my own mama. And the words themselves are gone. I just had the image of young Marie lost in the largest city on the planet
mm-hmm.
and going through this complicated labyrinth of streets, not knowing the language, afraid to talk to the police, that she could see every few blocks, and she finally found her way back all alone.
Wow.
She left New York. She fled New York because she didn't know if she was going to be apprehended and follow the waterways of New York. Now, she went up the Hudson River. If you've ever been to New York, you'll know that the Hudson River and goes up the east side of New York State up until it gets to what then was, and still is, I think, the Barge Canal.
Mm-hmm.
And she finally found refuge in a small community outside of Syracuse, very close to where I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And she met a fellow Ukrainian, and they raised a family. And basically, all the things that they talk about immigrants now, you know, they would have applied to my grandmother. She didn't know
sure,
English.
Oh, sure. Well, every culture has had that experience in America. The Irish were castigated a lot, and the French were for a time, but
the
some
Italians.
Of them were Anglo-Saxons made it okay, but everybody else had to pay their dues, so to speak, and it's unfair and unjust, but it has occurred many times in our culture.
My mother didn't speak English until she was 5 years old. She was raised without knowing how to speak English until she
right.
started going to school.
Mm-hmm.
After that, she translated for her mom.
Oh.
And there was one incident that I remember being told about, that my grandmother was living with my parents, and they were talking, my parents were talking quietly about the day's events, like, you know, married people do, and they were sharing their lives, and my mother's mother was listening. She was interested, but she certainly couldn't comprehend because they were talking in English. My dad left the room for some reason, and immediately my grandmother spoke with my mom in Ukrainian, and she was wondering, she assumed that they were talking about her, and she was asking quietly if she should move out.
Mm.
My mom called to my dad, and he went back in. He didn't know what emergency there was, and she told him what her mother had just asked. And so this I know happened because I remember the story. My parents embraced my grandmother together, and my mama was whispering with reassurance and love to my grandmother. And I think about Marie, my grandmother. I barely met her. She died when I was 7.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about the people that talk about those who don't speak the language, about language differences as a natural barrier meant to keep people out. One
right.
more way that God makes sure that America stays the same.
Oh,
and,
such ignorance, huh?
And I think of Marie, and I think of that she just proves otherwise from
yeah.
my own personal experience. I mean,
right.
I know that all that rhetoric isn't aimed at her. After all, she's Ukrainian.
No.
They're aimed at people that are darker,
sure.
people that are... That
anybody that's different. That's the whole problem.
You
know, anybody
yeah,
that's
so,
different.
You know, most of the immigration laws were not meant to keep Ukrainians out. They were meant to keep other people out. It,
right.
it was a Chinese, and then it was...
Oh, yeah.
But it was specific. It was ethnically based.
Yes.
It wasn't It wasn't to reduce the flow, except to reduce the flow of certain kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where a lot of this comes, nativism, you know, a lot of the things that are still socially acceptable to say today.
Yeah,
and,
unfortunately.
And even based people trying to get back to policies that were abolished in the 1960s.
Yeah.
Yeah, tell you, that is one poignant story.
That is a really great story. And in typical Bird-Deming fashion, he nailed us with that one statement, that woman was my grandmother. We had no idea you were heading in that direction, and all of a sudden you dropped it on us. Good job, Burr. Great storytelling and a wonderful story. And God bless your grandmother for, you know, having done all she did and for having it led to Bird-Deming being on our Sunday show today.
There you go.
Yeah, pretty good.
That made me think of a story. I'll just interject here real quick. The weekend before Labor Day, I flew home because my baby girl was turning 21. And I'm standing here in the Columbus airport, and this elderly Chinese couple, they were from mainland China. I was flying Southwest, so, you know, you get yourself queued up by the numbers and stuff. And they were looking at their ticket trying to figure out where. I could tell they were lost. They were confused. And I looked at them. I told them, okay, this is where you need to stand. And they were thankful. Then this other guy there obviously had been listening to the Rush Limbaughs or whatever the right-wing nut job aspects were. He said, they need to learn English. And I looked at him. I said, they're Chinese visitors. Please treat them like shit, right? Is that what you're saying? Basically, I called him out on it and embarrassed the hell out of him in front of the other passengers.
Yeah.
Now, he was also standing about 6'4". I stand about maybe 5'11".
Mm-hmm.
But I had no trouble standing toe-to-toe with it.
Good for you. Good for you, Wayne.
Thank you.
People like that
Thank
deserve
you.
To be called out now and then, and hopefully it shamed him.
Yeah. Oh, well. Yeah,
he reconsidered.
He looked at his number and said, yeah, I'm ahead of you. Let's go for it.
You know, it seems to me that a lot of the way, I mean, both sides of the fence seem to get votes is by making us afraid of certain issues and certain ultimatums politically on the global perspective to gather,
mm-hmm.
you know, our attention and to fear us into making a vote. That's basically what's going on there.
Well, it's been a long-term political tactic to use fear to try and get your point across or to scare people into submission to agree with what you're doing or permit you to do what you intend to do. And it's unfortunate, but it's as old as time itself. and it's going to continue to be employed for the rest of humanity's existence, unfortunately. We thought we'd gotten over Hitler and all that stuff. Look at what we've got. We've got the same kind of propaganda being employed on Fox News. It's more muted, but it's much the same tactics. The lies, lies, lies. Tell them over and over and over again. Before long, people are believing it to be the truth. And it's,
Jack, I don't think it's that muted sometimes.
Yeah, I agree. Well, it's Joseph Goebbels is very, very proud of what's going on at Fox News these days.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Burr, it's the same format. It's the same formula.
Yeah.
I would love to ask you, Burr, who do you think is showing the best in the political drama that's going on right now for the election coming up? Who do you like the most? Anybody?
I like Hillary. I really do. I like her a lot. She was hopelessly wrong on Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I like John F. Kennedy, and he was really wrong on Vietnam.
Right.
He was coming around. She came around.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much you can throw at somebody for that. People that are very, very close to me are extremely down on her for helping to get us into Iraq, for not being more skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't more skeptical. I was buying the mushroom cloud thing at the time.
Oh yeah.
You know, it goes back to the Vietnam thing in my own mind that these guys, I really think that Bush and company, I know that there's a lot that goes into decisions, and I know that part of the prevailing philosophy or the viewpoint, I guess I should say, is that they were acting on behalf of the oil industry and mm-hmm. Halliburton and things like that. But I really do think that they really were convinced that Iraq had something to do with 9/11. I really think that they thought that was true. And they certainly were, but they didn't have enough evidence to convince the country, and so they got into some of the other things. They said, well, we can't let this guy get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea here's the idea that I think they simply assumed couldn't possibly be, and that is, based on everything that they had been trained up to that point with the Soviet Union and that kind of evil in the world, that kind of destruction could not be assigned to the responsibility of a cartoon villain living in a cave on the other side of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was that would have been an absurd, that had to have been state sponsored. That's the only way that could happen. And so, therefore, what was going to be the culprit? You know, was it going to be Saudi Arabia, you know, which is where the evidence would have pointed if you were going to find a state sponsor, because that's mm-hmm. where these guys came from? Well, no. Can't be that, because they're not real hostile towards us. How about Afghanistan? Yeah, they're shielding the guy, but, geez, they didn't sponsor this. Who was really hostile to it? How about the guy who tried to assassinate a president who invaded another country that we had to go to war with, who was really... How about Saddam Hussein?
Yeah,
that
payback.
Certainly makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so therefore, let's... I think they really thought that he was responsible. And that idea just captivated them, and they couldn't let go of it.
Yeah, and they so much so that they just kept trying to find ways, even though they found no evidence, and repeatedly found no evidence, but they were convinced. They were just convinced beyond belief that this was true, and they were going to find evidence or manufacture it.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, Bert, let me interject here.
But Powell said he was asked to lie. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I was going to say,
right.
And Gwen, as you know, and I've said on the radio show here, I was doing encrypted communication with a company called Page One Science, located in Old Town Alexandria. The gentleman who owned the company was Marshall Shahoyan, and long story short was the encrypted communication, which would have been Donald Rumsfeld's briefcase, kind of like a cell phone on steroids, which could broadcast halfway around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard with my own ears, basically, it was all about the oil.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I know firsthand from my experience and history of work history and what I was involved with at the time, Bush administration knew that he did not have the weapons of mass destruction. Rumsfeld, through the Reagan years, sold to Iraq the mm-hmm. biological and the chemical weapons. The biological aspects were our strains of biological weapons. The chemical weapons were our chemical formulas.
Mm-hmm.
They sold it to, because he at the time he was using them against Iran in the Iraq-Iran war.
Right.
And they used the bank, BCC, Banks and Crooks and Criminals out of Italy, to do all the transactions and funding. They knew exactly what he had. We sold it to him during the Reagan/Rumsfeld connection. They knew that there was not nuclear weapons. They knew that it was not funded through them.
Right.
I'm just interjecting that. This is things that I know for a fact because
yeah.
I heard it firsthand.
Burr, you're on top of so many things, and you analyze them. You get the facts. You analyze them, and you make your judgments accordingly, and I salute you for that. And I wish we had about four more hours that we could just keep
yeah.
on going here. And I haven't asked you about Ferguson yet, and you live right by Ferguson, not too far away.
Yeah.
And so maybe we'll save that for another interview down the line. How does that sound?
Definitely
sure.
got to have him back.
Yeah.
back. Definitely
What's
have
that?
To have him back.
Yeah, we will definitely have to. Yeah, it's been very enjoyable. So
well, thank you for having me on.
Oh, anytime, Burr. And you can always call in every Sunday and comment on anything we're talking about if you like. You're more than welcome. We'd be glad to have you.
Thank you for coming on today and sharing with us. I really, really enjoyed the story about your grandmother very much.
Absolutely.
Oh,
touching. Touching.
Completely. It was wonderful and wonderfully delivered. That's what I love about your writing, Burr. You just shocked us at the very end by making that statement. And wow. It just knocked me over. It was so good. So that's the type of writing you find at fairandunbalanced.com, which Burr Deming is the proprietor of right now. And I encourage everybody who hasn't been there to please go there and check it out, and you won't be disappointed. I'm guaranteeing you that. So at any rate, Burr, I'm very grateful to you, and I'm very happy to announce that every Monday I have a podcast that you've put together that I feature on my my own site, the Saturday Afternoon Post. And your encouragement encouraged me to go beyond just the Saturday Post, so I post several times a week now. But yours is always there Monday for the readers to see and the listeners to listen to, and I'm very grateful for it, and it's wonderful to have. So keep up the good work, Burr. We're very grateful to you for being on our show today. It's been
a real pleasure.
Very much a pleasure. And we'll look forward to the return engagement.
Yes, it has. Thank you, Burr.
Thank you, Gwen.
Everyone can find Burr's writing at Fair and Unbalanced blog. All you have to do is type in to Google Fair and Unbalanced, and it comes right up to him. Please don't forget to check out Saturday Afternoon Post with Jack Jodell or The Minds and Times of F. Wayne Johnson. And please remember, we are sponsored by Roundtree 7. That's the number 7.com. Go check out that blog, too. Thank you for listening. This has been the Sunday Show with Jack Jodell, F. Wayne Johnson, and Gwen Berry. Please tune in again next. Thank you, guys.
Thank you,
Gwen.
Thank you, Burr, and Wayne.
Burr.
Nice talking with everybody. Have a great week, and keep pushing forward. We'll talk next Sunday.
And we'll see you again next week.
And that's all she wrote. Thank you for listening.